Eyes Art Strip, Monday nights at 9 p.m. Join us.
Coming up in 1 hour, Hour of the Wolf. It's 8 p.m. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Up next, Housing Notebook with Scott Somer.
Good evening and welcome to Housing Notebook here on WBAI in New York. My name is Scott Somer. I'm with the Metropolitan Council on Housing, New York City's oldest tenant union. If you need help with a housing problem, give Met Council a call at 212-979-0611. That's 212-979-0611, Monday or Wednesday from 1:30 to 8 p.m., Friday from 1:30 to 5 p.m. Once again, that's 212-979-0611. Monday and Wednesday, 1:30 to 8 p.m., Friday, 1:30 to 5 p.m., or you can come to our walk-in clinics we have on Tuesdays. The next one is tomorrow night, March 5th. It's going to be our downtown walk-in clinic. It's at Trinity Commons at 107 Greenwich Street in New York. It's from 6 to 8 p.m., and anyone from around the city, welcome to come. It's a mutual aid clinic. Please try to get there and register by 6 p.m., and we're there till 8. And, you know, we discuss our issues, our problems, and figure out ways to attack and attack the issues that we're having with our landlords. That's tomorrow, the March 5th, 6 to 8 p.m. is the downtown clinic. And then we will be back uptown at our uptown clinic, which is on March 11th. So that's a week from tonight, it looks like, the 11th. It's on a Monday. I thought it's on Tuesdays. For some reason, I have that. Maybe it's the 12th. I have that one listed as on one leaflet. I have it as the 11th. We'll check that for you next week. But that's going to be at CUNY in the Heights at 5030 Broadway. 5030 Broadway up in CUNY in the Heights. And that is at between 213th and 214th Streets. And I believe it's going to be on Tuesday, the 12th. I think it's a type on the one leaflet I have here. You take the A to 207th, the 1 to 215th, or the BX7 or the BX20 over there. But please arrive once again by 6 p.m., but we'll lock down that date for, I believe it's next Tuesday, a week from next Tuesday. So do come that, do that. You can follow Met Council on the web at metcouncilonhousing.org. That's metcouncilonhousing.org. And also our sister organization, Met Council Action, the tenant.org. And we're on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, X, whatever it's called now, Threads, all of them. And you can follow me on Twitter as well at Scott M. Sommer, ScottMSommer. We come to you Monday nights from 8 to 9 p.m. here on WBAI at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, WBAI.org on the web. You can listen to us anywhere. You can get the web. You can also come back and listen to a program you miss in the archive, or one that you love so much you want to hear it again, or you can download it, send the link, whatever, to somebody in our archive of past shows. And I am told by the ever-reliable Vajra Kilgaro that it's definitely March 12th, the Uptown 150-30 Broadway, which is what I thought. I just noticed this typo on the leaflet. So it's tomorrow night is the Downtown Clinic, and the Uptown Clinic's a week from tomorrow on the 12th, and all that information will be on our show page. If you go to WBAI.org, click on the program link and click on for Housing Notebook and look at tonight's program, you'll have all that information there for you. And while you're there, why don't you join WBAI, become a member of WBAI, and you become a member of WBAI by making a monthly pledge or an annual pledge and help keep us on the air. Because only WBAI would give a program the tenants for, it's got to be well over 50 years already, you know? So, that is a great asset that we in the housing movement have, and we need to support WBAI and help keep us on the air. So become a WBAI buddy. And one more thing to announce before we get to our guests. I'll do the rent guidelines and the heat stuff later on. A rally to stop deregulation all across New York City. Landlords, backed by government, are deregulating the last of our affordable housing stock. And Governor Hochul and Mayor Adams are really trying to weaken existing tenant protections and provide incentives to landlords and developers to throw us out of our homes. There'll be a rally in Brooklyn on Saturday, the 9th at noon, Saturday, March 9th at noon at 285 Eastern Parkway. Tenants from all over central Brooklyn, the Crown Heights Tenants Union are going to be getting together, and this is a rally at noon on March 9th at 285 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. Come on out and support the struggle for decent affordable housing in Brooklyn. Speaking of decent affordable housing, we're going to move quickly to our first guest this evening. And, we have, speaking of affordable housing, we have joining us this evening, back, I think, for her first time as an elected official, Senator Cordell Claire, who represents Harlem and other surrounding areas. We'll get to that in a second. But used to come to us many years ago when she was leading the fight for lead paint protections here in New York City. So it's nice to have you back after this time, Senator. And it's nice to call you. It's nice to call you Senator.
So. Thank you. It's nice to be back. Yeah. I'm still getting used to the name, but thank you.
It's nice when activists that do good things like yourself become elected officials, because that's really who should be up in Albany and Washington and other places. So it's always a thrill when we get to have, and we've also had Assembly Member Matanyas back on. Oh, and she used to come to us as a housing organizer in Brooklyn. So it's always fun. It's always fun when our friends from their prior lives get elected to office. And so I know generally your area is referred to Harlem, but it's actually much bigger than Harlem. And what do you cover?
Well, generally, it's part of the Upper West Side, all of West Harlem, Central Harlem, a big part of East Harlem, El Barrio, and a small portion of Washington Heights.
In fact, when I was announcing the Uptown Clinic that we do, it's actually not that far out of your district. I mean, it's open to anyone, but it's like it's a whole north of you, not far though.
Okay, where is it again? I'm sorry.
It's at CUNY in the Heights at I think it's like 215th and Broadway, so it's not too far from you.
Yeah, it's up there though.
Yeah, it's up there.
CUNY's campus is actually in my district.
You have the City College?
City College, yeah.
City College is a beautiful campus. And
beautiful,
We broadcast from there for a while after we got, after Sandy, when our studio was at 120 Wall Street and electricity was all destroyed. WHCR was nice enough to give us a studio. I used to love going up there. I was more thrilled about having a college ID again to get on campus. I felt all young again, so I had a college idea. But
I thought you were going to say you could get the discounts.
I know. I didn't try. I should have. But yeah. But yeah. It is a gorgeous campus. You're ever up near the CUNY campus, the Beautiful. City College, you'll walk through it. It's really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So we welcome you back here tonight. You know, we're going to hit on a few housing topics, but the one I wanted to start with you on is you and Assemblymember Gallagher from Brooklyn have co-introduced, you know, both the prime sponsors of the bill in the Senate and the Assembly, to create, I guess, what would be called a social housing development authority for New York. And I guess the first question I would ask is, what is a social, what would it be? What would the bill do, and what motivated you to want to introduce this legislation?
Yeah, so it would be an authority created for the purpose of creating housing and cutting out the middleman. We don't have to worry about that agency making a profit. They would actually address this crisis that we're in right now, which is a housing crisis, and not just any housing crisis. We're in an affordable housing crisis right now, and we need units that are affordable to be built. What inspired me, I know that Assemblywoman Gallagher and others did a trip to Vienna where they actually saw this, but my motivation has been all the years that we have given land, we have given tax credits, we have supported developers in the hopes of gaining housing that was affordable. It has not worked. And for us to keep on giving those tax breaks away, which costs the state money and revenue, that's money that we're forfeiting, that we're saying, here, you don't have to pay this. And on top of that, in some cases, even giving land and a low price property in the city, especially, and a lot of this was done in Harlem, and then we still wind up with housing that people can't afford to live in. That's not working. So you can't keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. And that was my motivation. I know that the best investment that was ever made was state-sponsored. Mitchell-Lama was one of the best programs ever created by the state. And we have to do that again, because we're at that point. We just can't afford to not build housing. Not to say that we don't need housing for other people, but right now we have so many people struggling and suffering. A lot of people are yelling about the migrant crisis. We had a housing crisis before the migrants came. Our shelters were swelling with families. And even those who are housed right now, so many people are standing on pantry lines, are skimping. They're not eating properly. They're not feeding. They're not living. They're spending 50%, 75% of their earned income, what they bring home, on rent. And that's not the way people are supposed to live.
And you represent an area that has really gone through a major, I mean, if I'm going to use the neutral word, say transformation, but a major gentrification.
Gentrification is the word.
Yeah.
I mean, extremely, and still going through it. And not only that, you know, the New York Times reported a couple of years ago about the exodus of Blacks from this city. So it has racial implications. 200,000 Black people left left New York State. They didn't go somewhere else, you know, they moved here, there. No, they left the state because they couldn't afford to live here. And that number has increased since that report was made. Many are moving out. It's typical for me to get a call on a weekend or sometime in the week from Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, all people I grew up with in my community saying, hey, come down and visit me. You know, all my contemporaries, they had to leave. They took their families and they left. And our families, you know, growing up in the Harlem that I grew up in and how we raised our children, we said, you know, do your best. Stay out of trouble. Don't get into any problems. Don't go to jail. Do this. Go to school. Go away. Go to college. Come back. Give back. And we can build back our community. Our children have done everything that we asked, but they can't come back here. They can't come back because they can't afford to live here. You know, I have a nephew. He graduated college and he said, Auntie, I can't afford to live there. And then he showed me what he got where he went to school in the South. And I told him, just make sure you remember I'm your favorite aunt. Okay. When I looked at his place, and I said, this is this is crazy what we're doing. So we're not just hurting ourselves in terms of not housing people. We're hurting ourselves because the talent and the people who were raised here and who grew up here and who can help us build the city back the way we need it are not able to come here.
So in with the Social Housing Development Agency, with the authority, whatever, would it be housing that is built, funded, and built by developers and turned over to them? Who would actually own the housing? And then, because, you know, you talk about Mitchell-Lama, but we know there are Mitchell-Lamas that have left the program, Section 8 developments that have left the program because they finish their tax benefits and then they have an option to leave if they want. But how would this be different?
So the residents would have control over their buildings management as well as seats on the board, the Social Housing Development Authority Board, alongside labor unions and affordable housing practitioners. These are the type of people that will run that board and make sure that this stays permanently affordable, that we are not looking for profit, that we are not looking, we are looking to keep this housing affordable permanently.
And would it be mixed income housing, or would it all be towards?
No, no, no. It would be mixed income, but it would be a good portion of it to low income, no income, very low income. And then there would be other incomes. You know, right now, the average, just speaking of the exodus of Black people out of this state, the average income of Blacks across New York State is $53,000 a year. Those are facts. And this is not take home. This is just $53,000, a little over $53,000 statewide. The average median income of Blacks in New York City in the five boroughs is $43,000. When you have rents, and I've seen them in my district, for $3,000, $4,000 a month, $5,000 a month, you have already exceeded the median income of people that there's no way they could ever even reach that. So they're always reaching behind. We have to build housing according to the income of New Yorkers, and we have to create workforce housing for our teachers, for our social workers, who we need so badly, for our mental health workers, all our healthcare workers. We need those kinds of units. People can't afford, and this is not just, I'm pointing out, you know, the racial implication, but it's not just Blacks. It's not just people who are making very low incomes. I have people who have to leave because they can't afford to pay rent and childcare. You know, I was talking to a young lady who belonged to one of the organizations in my district on the Upper West Side a couple months ago. And we were actually announcing someone new that was going to be taking her place. And I said, oh, you know, this is a nice person. I like her. But why are you leaving? We love you. Why are you going? And she said, well, I'm technically already a resident of the Bronx. And I said, why'd you do that? So she said, my rent was going up to $6,000 a month. My child care is $3,400 a month. Who can live with that?
So she's knocking on $10,000 a month before she even buys a piece of food.
That's right. That's right. Before she pays a phone bill, before she pays any kind of transportation costs, food, you name it. This is child care, a toddler and her husband, and they are paying $10,000. And just that alone, that's no way to live. You can't enjoy what you're working for, even if you can afford it or if you can afford to pay it.
So this obviously, you know, people are sitting back and saying, well, this sounds great, but it costs a lot of money. So how, I mean, I think one of the reports I read, I guess the, was it $5 billion? So what would be looking for to start $5 billion between bonds and state subsidies to... Right. For the capital to start it up?
The initial capitalization would be $5 billion, and the authority would create or acquire 26,000 new union-built homes with that. And the savings for us here is, here you would have the agency that could finance, that could build, that could even acquire property, distressed properties. All of this can be done under one roof by one agency. And they're not looking for this high profit margin. Their goal is to build affordable housing. They can rezone. They will have those powers to do that.
And would the funding be through direct budget appropriation, or would they have to be floating bonds? How would they be raising? That's a, it's a lot of money to raise. Not that, that is, you know, not that New York doesn't have the money sitting there if they only taxed people properly, but I mean, how would they raise the money?
Tax certain people properly.
Probably, right. Right.
Yes. You know, to raise $5 billion, if the political will was there, we could do it. You know, we never ask people, where are we going to find money to build a prison? This is housing that people need in New York State. And yes, they would be floating bonds, and the agency, all the rents, everything that comes in would be going towards the upkeep of the housing and creation of new housing.
And this would be statewide. This is just not a New York City proposal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, it's not. It's not just
because the need is great throughout the state.
The need is throughout. I hear from my colleagues in other counties, unbelievable, that there is just not enough housing. But it's not good enough. You know, everyone says, yes, we have to build more. It's not just build more. Yes, build more, but you have to build it according to the incomes. You have to build it for your workforce. You have to build it for your seniors. This is the fastest growing population. People's incomes don't generally go up. It gets fixed or it stays the same. Sometimes it goes even lower. We need to build housing. I can't tell you how many seniors everyone asks for housing, but seniors particularly, and these are 5 and 6 year waiting lists that they have to get on just to hope that they can get in to a senior unit. It shouldn't be like that.
Mm-hmm. And I see I buy the Daily News still, and I see often they have those ads for the senior housing in there, and it's like few and far between. It's only a few units here and there. And you even look at some of the rents sometimes, and like, I don't even know how the seniors could afford them. You know,
there you go. And I have seniors that complain about, you know, they have to choose which day they want to take their medication, which medication they're going to take or buy, because it's a juggle. It's a juggle between food, medicine, and rent. That's not living, especially for people who have given to this city, who have worked all their lives, who have raised families, whether they were employed on a job or not, they've contributed to this city. It's not fair. That's not the way we should be treating the residents of our city and our state. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, this is Housing Notebook on WBAI in New York. My name is Scott Somer. I'm chatting with New York State Senator Cordell Claire from Harlem and beyond, basically a nice big district up there, the Upper West Side up to East and West Harlem and up towards the lower reaches, I guess, of Washington Heights. And we're talking about the legislation she has introduced along with Assemblymember Gallagher in the Assembly. If you want the bill numbers, to create a social housing development authority for truly tenant-controlled housing. Actually, we in Met Council have a very big affinity towards it because for many years we had our book was Housing in the Public Domain, the Only Solution. And this is what this would be: housing controlled by tenants, you know, a social. And it's been we referenced earlier that we had the folks on last November. They joined us who had gone to Vienna and saw how it's been happening in Vienna for like over 100 years. They've been doing this quite successfully. So the bill, if you want, by the way, it's in the Senate, it's Bill 8494. In the Assembly, it's Bill 9088, because some of our listeners like to go and read these things and get yourself a good cup of coffee. It's about a 39-page bill. So, but that's what you'll be creating from scratch. So what's the prospects? I mean, I know it's the first year you guys just introduced it. We are in budget season. We have 27 days, I guess, before the state budget is due. Is this going to be discussed during the state budget? Is this one of these after budget things, notwithstanding the fact that it needs money? I mean, where do you see this going right now?
I think being as young as it is a topic right now, but I think it's something that's going to be discussed outside of the budget. I really have to thank Assemblywoman Gallagher for bringing it and asking me to join her and pushing this forward because we had to do something different. And at least it begins a conversation about something that's real and something that is going to truly address the problem that we have. I look at what I see, I look at the papers, I go online, even Housing Connect, and I look at what people are calling affordable. Okay. It's ridiculous. These are not real people that I know. These are not real people. I've had people go to some of these that were lucky enough to get called in. I had a family, mother, a toddler, father, go in for this. They had qualified. They were so excited. And they went into the property. And even at this rent, which I didn't think was affordable, that they had gotten it for, they said, okay, this is nice. They showed them a one bedroom. They said, yeah, but we wanted a two bedroom because we have a baby and, you know, we want to have a room and the baby could have a room. And they told them, you can't afford it. This is all you can afford. So you're going to live uncomfortably. You're for that kind of money. Okay. And they were talking $2,500 a month. This was affordable. That's not affordable to people who are making $35,000, $40,000 a year. This is a large portion of their rent. A large portion of their income. And to have children in this city is just something, you know, everybody's going to, I don't know who they're building this for.
And they're setting that family up for, I don't want to say failure, but for like a very tense situation. Granted, the baby could share a room, but, you know, that baby turns into a toddler pretty quick. And they need a bedroom, you know. And it wasn't that they were saying you're not eligible for a two bedroom. They said you can't afford it.
Can't afford it, exactly. You can't afford it by your income structure. So it's not. We're not building for who we have here in this city. The workers that we have here in this city, the teachers that we have here, the nurses. You know, you don't want everybody outside of New York City. People can, they'll just go and try to make a life somewhere else. Mm-hmm. We have to make it comfortable for people to live here. All kinds of people, mm-hmm. all kinds of incomes, and we can do it.
Shifting gears in the few minutes left that we have with you, you know, talking about another form of affordable housing, and you have, I believe you probably have one of the largest swaths of public housing, NYCHA housing, in the city, maybe the most in Manhattan. The question I have, I made a so report last week, there are 5,000 vacant NYCHA apartments citywide. We talked about on the show last week, and it said it takes NYCHA 340 days, it's close to a year, to turn around an apartment. In part, and you're the perfect person to talk to about this, in part because they can't abate the lead paint fast enough, besides the other capital stuff they have. What's your reaction to that? I mean, there must be hundreds of vacant apartments in your district alone.
Yeah, to me, that my reaction is that's nonsense. We're not treating this like the crisis that it is. And that they can't get to those units, but we can pay that money in shelter costs. We can pay that money in hotel costs. It's nonsense to me. We're paying much more to house people in shelters, in hotels, than it would cost to fix those apartments, abate those apartments, and make them habitable and safe.
Is there any talk in Albany about the state pumping capital money into NYCHA to help them get on the stick there, or figure out what their operations are? It just seems like from the article I read, it was like one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing, and they're 3 feet apart from each other.
It's the management of things. Now, the state has historically never given to NYCHA, but since I've been here in the last 2 years, we have come up with last year almost $400 million to pay ERAP. We didn't pay ERAP, Emergency Rental Assistance. For some reason, we didn't give it to NYCHA. So these past 2 years, we have been giving record amounts of money to help pay that ERAP bill. I'm advocating for us to infuse NYCHA with some money so that they can bring these units online. The money that we're looking to create housing, let's preserve the truly affordable housing that we already have. That's a part of it. We've moved forward and talked about we're going to build all these thousands of units of housing, but we're losing it at the other end. It doesn't make sense. So even if you build it affordable, you still are not meeting the need because we're losing, the bucket is leaking from the bottom. So these units are very important. It's important that we get those units fixed. Stop spending all this money to house people in shelters, redirect our priorities, and get people living in permanent, affordable housing.
Thank you. I want to thank you. It's so nice to have you back. And You're welcome back anytime. Is there anything you want to talk about? Just let us know. You're always welcome to join us, Senator.
Thank you so much. And thank you for what you do and keep doing. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. We've been chatting with Senator Cordell Claire about the legislation she's introduced with Assemblymember Gallagher to create a social housing development authority for New York State. You're tuned to Housing Notebook on WBAI in New York. And we're going to go to our next guest in just a moment. So we're going to take a little break and then we're going to go down. We're going to go downtown. That's how I should have played it. I should play the music downtown. We're going to go downtown in just a minute or two. Talk about some big news from Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village. And we're going to do that as soon as we take a little break. And you can listen to this. You tune to Housing Notebook on WBAI in New York. Housing Notebook here on WBAI in New York. My name is Scott Somer. I'm with the Metropolitan Council on Housing. And we're now heading downtown. We were just speaking to Senator Claire from up in Harlem. We're now heading downtown to talk about a recent victory, which we mentioned briefly last week, at Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village. And, of course, I can never talk about Stuytown, Peter Cooper Village, without remembering the longtime that council activist Franz and Rosa Lehman, now departed from this planet, but were original Stuytown tenants. They were original tenants. As Rosa used to say, MetLife wanted nothing more than to have her move out. And involved in the struggle to deregulate, desegregate, Stuytown. And as Franz once showed me a list that had gotten, I guess, of the order of the tenants that were, the holdovers were being brought against to evict them back in the day. And because of an alphabetizing error, their holdover case wasn't brought when it should have been. And as a result, they never got evicted. But anyway, we're now joined this evening by Susan Steinberg, the president of the Stuytown Peter Cooper Village Tenants Association, and Ann Greenberg, the vice president, and their lawyer, Tim Collins, who's many of you have listened to Housing Notebook have probably heard Tim many times over the years. He's been our resident scholar on the Rent Guidelines Board for decades, going back so far that he and I had more hair and it was darker when we first met. But welcome to all three of you. And Susan, I'll start with you. Just if you could, just in case there's somebody in this city who doesn't know about Stuytown Peter Cooper Village, where is it? What is it? Like a little bit of the history of how it came about.
Sure. Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village occupy, the geography is from 14th Street and First Avenue to Avenue C and 14th Street, and then over north to 23rd and 1st, and then to 23rd and C. So it's 80 acres. We have 11,242 now rent-regulated units, now and forever. And we are, there must be about 30,000 residents. We were built, I wasn't there yet, but we were built in 1947. And for middle-income people, for returning veterans, for the nurses, the firemen, the teachers, people like that. And over the decades, these people mostly had to leave because the rents just kept skyrocketing up.
Mm-hmm. And it was built in 46, and then in what, 2006, MetLife, which had also built an accompanying project up in Harlem, which was for Black people. Then Stuytown was only for white people. That's a whole other story, a whole other show. Was that called Riverton? Was the one uptown? Is that what that was called? Riverton.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And in 2006, MetLife sold your complex, Stuytown and Peter Cooper Village. Peter Cooper Village, most famous for the ability to have air conditioning when Stuytown couldn't. I forget one of the comics who grew up in Stuytown talked about how he always wanted to make a friend in Peter Cooper Village. He'd go hang out in their apartment in the summer. They sold it to MetLife. MetLife sold it to Tishman Speyer for like an insane amount. I remember at the time when they bought it, I was like, oh, they have one plan, and that was to basically get rid of all of you. And then it ended up passing hands again, you know, to a capital servicer who then sold it to Blackstone. And if you can, who is Blackstone? I mean, we always hear about them, but who are they?
They're a $1 trillion multinational company who owns probably 3/4 of the world by now.
Yeah, they may be the world's largest landlord. They've actually been cited by the United Nations for bad practices elsewhere.
Oh, I did not know that they earned the badge of a UN citation of sorts. So that's even new. Yeah, Blackstone, I mean, they're basically, it's a... People don't think of them as a landlord because they think of them as like this big like money company, but they're actually really, they describe themselves as an asset, alternative asset management company or something.
Well, right. They've been buying up properties all throughout the United States and all throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, so Anne, bring you into the conversation a bit as well. What happened, you know, under the ownership of these, like, basically hedge funds and money changers and not money changers, but money investors, whatever. What happened under their, what were they trying to do? Driving, get people out? What was their goal?
Well, You have to go back actually to MetLife a bit to understand. MetLife, when they developed this and got, you know, a 25-year tax abatement, they raised a whole neighborhood, but they were not a public company at the time. And when they became a public company, all of a sudden they had shareholders that they were going to have to be responsible to, and shareholders want to see a return on their investment. And that just changed the whole landscape. Even though they said, well, this no longer fits with the rest of our business, but in fact, it never really did fit with the rest of their business necessarily. So they put it up for sale. There was a frenzy, which has been documented, and it ended up going for $5.4 billion to Tishman Speyer and BlackRock. But as Charles Bagley explained in his book, Other People's Money, it was really leveraged, and they didn't, ultimately, they could not cover their debt obligations, and it had to get turned over to the debt servicer, CW Capital. But how do you make more money? One way is, how do you raise the rents? And a way to raise the rent is to renovate vacant apartments and get them past the threshold of when you can deregulate an apartment. And this was not actually very difficult, because I believe at the time, you could add 1/40th of the cost of the renovation to the rent. So they would put in $40,000, add $1,000 to the existing rent, and immediately it was over the threshold, and they started deregulating, and then they just kept jacking the rents up from there. And then, of course, once they got into trouble and CW took it over, and I think they probably extracted a lot of monies and management fees and prolonged the process, then they put it up for sale again, and Blackstone was the one who bought it for, I think, $5.3 billion, so a little bit less. And the model, you know, but the model had continued, except somebody figured out that by getting a tax break called a J-51, you could not take the apartments out of regulation. And that led to what is now a landmark case. It was a class action suit. It's called Roberts versus Tishman Speyer. And all those apartments that had been deregulated, 44,311 of them, they had to go back into regulation, albeit at high rents, but they were still had enjoyed the protections of rent regulation.
Mm-hmm. And if you're just tuning in, we're chatting with Susan Steinberg, president of the Peter Cooper Village Tenants Association, and also Ann Greenberg, the vice president, and Tim Collins, their lawyer. We'll get to Tim in a moment. You know, you mentioned the strategy that they were employing to, like, deregulate apartments in the law that then existed at the time, if you got them over a certain threshold. But I also know they were bringing many frivolous lawsuits, because, you know, from my own work as a tenant activist and from friends who lived at Stuytown, I had friends who actually were living there, their primary residence, who would then get, like, lawsuits against them saying that it wasn't their prime resident because, yeah, you know, maybe it was their mother who, and they grew up in the apartment. They lived there their whole life.
Right.
But mom had retired or moved somewhere else.
Well, what we discovered is that when somebody would renew, when it was time for renewal, they'd go and do a credit check. And if they saw anything, such as the person had a second home, or they had a car registration that wasn't in the city, they immediately decided that these people were not legitimately living here as their primary residence. And you have to live here 183 days to make sure that it's a primary residency. So they were just going after people left, right, and center. And to the degree whereby our then councilman, Dan Gorodnick, created a free legal clinic for people that were having to prove that they were indeed primary lessees.
Mm-hmm. Right, because a lot of people couldn't afford the lawyer fees, and, you know, MetLife or Tishman Speyer or whomever, you know, figured they would get you out just by wearing you out. You didn't live there the 183 days a year. So let's fast forward a little bit. Obviously, you know, the only strategy when you pay $5.4 or $5.3 billion, you know, way over market for something, you know, even as big as Stuytown is, you know, it should never have sold for that kind of money. You know, the rent roll didn't, you know, couldn't make it. The only way you could do it is by throwing people out, getting rid of people. So fast forward here. Tim Collins, welcome. Nice to have you here with us as always.
Good to be back, Scott.
Yeah, and I apologize. Spaced my mind that you were the lawyer on this. I forgot. And Susan called me today and said, can we invite the lawyer? And she mentioned, I said, of course, Tim. It's like, yeah, so, of the firm Collins, Dopkin, Miller. The Dopkin now retired, I gather, right? My old
semi retired. He still shows up at all the firm meetings and, still works with us on a couple of cases.
Right. The only person who's ever been able to come on Housing Notebook and explain the then maximum base rent formula for rent controlled apartments in language that people could understand it. So,
Steve Dopkin is the only person in the galaxy who actually understands the formula. So,
right. But which is no more because of the changes in the law. But yes, that's right. Tim, they mentioned, Ann and Susan mentioned the J51 tax abatement, which obviously when you were J51, you're supposed to be under rent stabilization. You're supposed to be what? And the Roberts case, what happened at Stuytown and Peter Cooper Village in particular that, made this so pivotal?
Well, there was a massive class action suit. There was a settlement. Within the settlement, the contemplation was that the tenants would get a certain amount of benefit. They would get payment for overcharges at a fixed rate. And that on June 30th, 2020, all of those units that had come under rent stabilization by virtue of the J51 program would go out of it. Now, under the Roberts litigation and the issues at stake there, they would not have been deregulated but for the settlement. The settlement was a way to solve a lot of complex problems. And then in 2019, the state legislature extends rent stabilization. So by extending it prospectively, it appeared under the law, and without going into detail, that they recaptured all of these units that came out of the J51 program and put them back under stabilization. And, of course, this was vigorously fought by Blackstone, really on two grounds. One ground being that the deal that was made Roberts settlement was binding, invested, and couldn't be interrupted by future legislation. And the second thing is an interpretation of the rent stabilization code, which suggested that if these units might have or theoretically would have been deregulated on the basis of high rent vacancy deregulation during the period in which they received J51, then once the J51 abatement expired, they would be deregulated. And so with respect to the first issue, we made the argument that prospective legislation cannot be reined in by contracts which, immunize owners from tenant protections going forward in perpetuity. There has to be a point in time in which, legislation can cover. And our argument was, when is that point in time? It's not specified in the agreement. It certainly can't go on in perpetuity. So our position is that, if a new rent law extends protections one nanosecond after the purported deregulation under this agreement, then they're covered. So that covered that issue. With regard to the, administrative law issue, we just argued that this, theoretical deregulation was really not the purpose of the provision of the rent stabilization code that we were focused on, that it really had nothing to do with deregulation. It just had to do with how you set rents once the J51 is expired under some circumstances. And Scott, you'll probably recall that if you were rent regulated before you received the J51, and once the J51 expires, you're rent regulated after. The only exception was these off-ramps created by high rent vacancy deregulation. The off-ramps were taken away with the HSTPA of 2019. And so consequently, we took the position that when you go back to the original status prior to J51, you're rent stabilized. They said, no, well, if you could have been rent deregulated, during this period, you would be deregulated. But we were successful before Justice Robert Reed in the state Supreme Court. We got a favorable decision on both counts. I had another Supreme Court action, also a favorable decision. There was another Supreme Court action called, we refer to it as the Tuan Mai case, which did go to the appellate division on the issue of this administrative law question, and the court ruled in favor of the tenant in that case. So we were pretty strongly situated to win this appeal had it gone forward. Blackstone pushed to enlarge their time to perfect appeal. We pushed back saying that, you know, they had already had a year and they were doing some tactical maneuvering in order to let other cases, which may have been less compelling, bubble up. They were supposed to perfect their appeal by the, I think it was the 20th or the 21st, and the U.S. Supreme Court came down with its cert decisions the following day. And they had a motion pending to enlarge that was based upon the outcome of that U.S. Supreme Court review. Of course, they denied the cert petitions and sort of derailed the effort to.
For the listeners to be clear on this, it was the remaining cases that were pending before the Supreme Court, which potentially could have overturned rent regulation. And the court said, we're not going to do it. Although Clarence Thomas, of course, invites them to come back another day. But that's another story.
Yeah. That's right. And so given that their argument to enlarge their time to perfect their motion or their appeal fell apart once the Supreme Court denied those petitions, and they were already a day late in perfecting under the prior schedule that had already been established, they were kind of in a corner, and they just said, we're going to give up the appeal.
It's not because of their unwavering commitment to the tenants at Stuytown that they talk about in their press release. That's not why they gave up their appeal.
Well, you know, listen, it's easy to be honest, easy to be cynical. The thing is that my experience dealing with Blackstone is that they were aggressive. They were very thorough. They did want to win this. But they did play inside the ballpark in a very businesslike way. And as you know, dealing with landlord-tenant law throughout the city for many decades, not every landlord firm does that. So it was sort of refreshing to know that, you know, everybody understood where the center field wall was.
That's rare these days in this country.
So, yes.
In a minute or two, we have left this. Thank you for that. It was a very, as always, cogent, understandable legal explanation. Although I do want to observe, I've seen some press reports where other landlord groups are really pissed off at Blackstone for yanking the appeal. And they're all saying, we'll be back because we have other cases, as you referenced, percolating through the system. So this issue is not dead, probably, because, you know, they'll keep taking their shots at rent regulation to try to get another case maybe before the Supreme Court if they don't succeed in New York. But Susan, I assume the tenants must be ecstatic. I mean, you guys were like on the death knell door like not many years ago, and now it's like these apartments are staying in rent stabilization.
You know, Scott, when we heard that they actually were not going ahead with the appeal, I felt I had brain freeze. I mean, we had been preparing for a very long haul, because from the time we filed our lawsuit in March of 2020 until Justice Robert Reed's ruling in January of 2023, until now, it just looked like it would just be years. And I used to think, you know, I may not live to see the end of it. So, of course, I'm thrilled. I can see that I actually have a few years ahead of me. And all the tenants that we essentially saved are thrilled as well. But I have to thank all of our electeds that stood with us. And I'd also like to call out the Attorney General, who participated with an amicus brief and who sent a really fine deputy to oral arguments. She was just terrific. Esther
Mordecaieva,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, we have a great Attorney General on a whole host of reasons in New York. We have a great Tish James, a dear friend of Met Council's and of tenants. No, it's great. It's exciting. And it's not just what you say for everyone who's living there, but for the future. I mean, you know, we spent the first half of the show talking about the lack of anything remotely affordable in New York, and the fact that, you know, Stuytown, you know, has been preserved as a rent stabilized development, 11,200 apartments. Imagine if we lost 11,200 apartments from rent stabilization and the eviction protections that come with them. just imagine the impact that would have on the ability for families to stay in New York. So this is great. It's really exciting. Congratulations, I guess, is what I could say. And people can, you guys have a website. You just Google the Stuytown Peter Cooper Village Tenants Association. It brings it right to your website, and you have your press release there, and actually the stipulation. It's amazing. You talk about such a big lawsuit, it gets reduced down to like three paragraphs ending it. It's always kind of fun to look at those things. And it ended with prejudice, so they can't bring this lawsuit. They can't come back on this issue. They're done. It's good.
It is done.
It is done. Congratulations, Susan Steinberg, Ann Greenberg, Stuytown, Peter Cooper Village Tenants Association. And there is air conditioning in Stuytown now, by the way. Everyone should know. They upgraded the wiring. I'm sure they got an MCI for that. And
you better believe it.
Oh, yeah. And Tim Collins from Collins, Dopkins, and Miller. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. And you've been tuned to Housing Notebook here on WBAI in New York. The Hour of the Wolf coming up at 9 o'clock. We'll be with you again next Monday night. Need help with a housing problem? Give Met Council a call, 212-979-0611. That's 212-979-0611. Thank you all. Take it away, Max.
I'm going to tell you a story about the house that blew. I had a good job showing up for 5 long years. Lord have mercy. The old landlady was so lovey-dovey for 5 long years. She was so nice and kind in every way. Every Friday evening I come home with my paycheck. She'll smile. She was so lovey-dovey. My meal's on time. My bath water be ready. Everything be ready. It rocked on. One Friday evening I come home. I said, landlady. She said, what, Johnny? I done lost my job. She said, what?
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's 2 overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
Join us on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. for the Independent News Hour, the weekly radio show of The Independent, New York City's radical newspaper. Each week, we speak with the activists, organizers, and social movement thought leaders who are fighting for a more just and equitable New York. That's The Independent News Hour, Tuesdays, 5 to 6 p.m., only here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
For vaccination, all across the nation, keep it from catching monkeypox.
Extinction Diaries. No, that's better. After 50 years of being undetected on Earth, the elephant shrew has been rediscovered in the country of Djibouti, Africa. The last scientifically confirmed sighting was in the 1970s. The local human population has never considered the animal extinct, but scientists were unaware of this. Elephant shrews, or senges, are neither elephants nor shrews, but related to aardvarks, elephants, and manatees. They have distinctive trunk-like noses, which they use to feast on insects. There are 20 species of senges in the world, and the elephant shrew is the most elusive, having disappeared from all other known locations. This is great news, but also highlights just how close to extinction the little critter is. Scientists captured live video, the first ever, and no local deforestation threatens them at the moment. Their chance of survival is more likely to depend on global efforts, the same one to prevent our own extinction, stop man-made greenhouse gases, and slow global warming, and an all-out effort to stop pollution. My name is Arne Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Well, we're moving on. Hey, this is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Same great soulful sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio. Sweet Tuesday, darling, Tuesday, everything
is Tuesday, Tuesday, Tuesday. And tonight at 10 p.m., Night Shift with Mike Sargent and the gang.